Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. Happy Kwanzaa to those who celebrate. Hope you had a nice Christmas and Hanukkah. And I hope you're enjoying your holiday season here. We're still not quite out of it yet. We're in the home stretch, but we are still officially in the holiday season. And of course, it wouldn't be an In the Middle if we didn't go out of this year with a bang. Now, you may remember a couple weeks ago, I did a show about 2022, a year in review. And that was the first part of our series where we were discussing the biggest moments of the year that happened right on this show. But now we're going to dig into the top political stories of the year overall that may have not been on this show, may have not been covered all the way. And we're going to have Fernando Uribe coming up. Dr. Fernando Uribe will be telling us what he thinks the biggest stories are and what to look out for next year. So you don't want to miss for that. Stay tuned here. There's a lot to talk about. Let's get right in the middle of it. This week, we'll be breaking down the top stories. We've got 10 of them, and it took us some time to think about it. There were probably 20 stories we were considering for this, and we narrowed it down to 10 for you. Because naturally, you don't have all day and night to sit there listening to me talk about all these stories. You need the big top 10. What's going to bring it home for you? So we compiled a list here to discuss all that. So let's break this down here because we're in the final show of 2022, if you can believe it or not. It just flew by. We had a lot of great guests, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to them and that you've learned a lot of great information about these people that we have on, as well as the political issues that affect the state of New Jersey and beyond. Now, let's get to my top 10 here. As I said, a lot to talk about. And we're going to go to number 10, which would be the Inflation Reduction Act. President Biden signed his landmark piece of legislation into law this year, which he argues will reduce inflation. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing. There's a whole messaging war about this, whether this really would bring down inflation or not. Republicans have argued it doesn't actually reduce inflation, that because of the amount of government spending, it will actually increase it in the long run. Now, the law includes funding for climate initiatives, the ability to negotiate prescription drug prices, a 15% minimum corporate tax, and also adds more resources for the IRS, which critics of the bill say will allow them, and over the next few years, be able to hire 87,000 new IRS agents to collect the taxes that they have in this bill, including there's a 1% charge on stock exchanges as well. So there's a lot in this bill to go over. The Democrats will argue in the long run will help reduce the inflation, while some are saying, well, listen, it might do something about affordability, but it doesn't do anything about the inflation. So the big deal is that Joe Biden was really trying to get the Build Back Better initiative over the finish line. But as you know, when we discussed on last year's show, that really didn't happen. Basically, it's almost like a rebrand that they had to do with the messaging again to tackle a big problem. So they put inflation on it and tried it that way, as opposed to Build Back Better that had Joe Manchin kind of hanging in the leaves there saying, nope, I ain't support. That's where we left at this time last year. But they got Joe Manchin on board this year, the Democratic senator from West Virginia. But they made a promise to him that they'd pass his big energy bill that would benefit the state of West Virginia. Well, here's the deal on that. That bill never got passed. And that's got Joe Manchin fuming here. Not fuming like Kyrsten Sinema, who is leaving the Democratic Party. She's now an independent, but he has not ruled out the possibility of that. So something to watch in 2023 will be whether Manchin leaves the Democratic Party and whether he actually leaves the Democratic caucus in the Senate to go caucus with the Republicans. Right now, there are three independents in the United States Senate. They have Kyrsten Sinema, the newest gang member to the group. You got Angus King from Maine, who's an independent. And you got Bernie Sanders, who is from Vermont and, as you know, has run for president twice, but as a Democrat. So he likes to go back and forth. So Manchin would have, he would have a group to get along with there if that's where he decided to lay his cards down. Now we have to go to the number 9 slot here. And this is a little closer to home for us. And that would be the New Jersey sex education curriculum. Although it was based on a pair of bills that came out of the state legislature and adopted by the New Jersey Board of Education in 2020, outrage was in full gear this year as school districts were required to implement this coming fall. Although it was based on a pair of bills passed by the state legislature and adopted by the New Jersey Board of Education in 2020, outrage was in full gear this year as school districts were required to implement it this fall. The most controversial parts of the standards include teaching gender identity to second graders, as well as sexual feelings and masturbation to students in the fifth grade. Some schools have resisted enacting the curriculum, but most districts, as of the current count that I could find, have implemented it in some form. Republicans have galvanized on this issue, attempting to stop the implementation, but it ultimately didn't work. This all essentially started from the outrage from the proposed curriculum in Westfield, where basically they were talking about boy parts and girl parts, and that this was proposed curriculum for second graders in that school district. Of course, this is what came out at a February school board of education meeting, and then it kind of circulated to the top of the fold in April, when it was brought to Holly Schapese's attention in April-ish because some constituents brought it to her, and she kind of made it a national issue from that point on because it started carried in conservative media, and then it went beyond conservative media, and local outlets like NJ.com started to cover it. And this is an issue we're going to watch in 2023, see if this galvanizes people. Is this type of issue going to upset parents so much that they may have traditionally voted Democrat, they're going to now vote Republicans in this next election in 2023? And by that, I'm talking about the state legislature elections. Or at the very least, is it just going to galvanize the Republicans who may have sat on the sidelines, but they're like, you know what? There's too much on the line here. I have to vote this year. And will that outnumber the amount of Democrats that would typically come out? All things we're going to keep an eye on and why this story is so important. Now let's move on to number 8. The confirmation of Ketanji Brown Jackson. This was a very historic story. President Biden nominated Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson as the first black woman to ever sit on the Supreme Court. Now, despite this, and having a pretty decent margin of confirmation, Republicans largely painted her as an extremist for not being able to define a woman. You may remember that moment between her and Marsha Blackburn when Marsha Blackburn said, "Hey, can you give me the definition of a woman?" And she said, "No, I can't. I'm not a biologist." And that got a lot of play on conservative media, and that was used against her. Also, they criticized her for lean sentences in child pornography cases. Ultimately, that did not stop her from getting Senate confirmation. The Senate confirmed her 53-57 with Utah Senator Mitt Romney, Maine's Susan Collins, and Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, all crossing party lines to support her. Now, the interesting part of why she was appointed was kind of interesting. She was replacing outgoing, now former Justice Stephen Breyer, who was in his 80s. He was receiving some pressure to retire because of what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, where she was pressured to retire. She said, no, I'm not doing that. Then she ended up dying while serving on the bench. And that was during Donald Trump's, actually it was during his reelection year in 2020. And it was still during his, towards the end of his term, he appointed her, he nominated her, and the Senate rammed her through. But they got a third Supreme Court justice in 4 years. So that gave them enough to make a lot of landmark decisions, which we're going to talk about later on here, because boy, did a lot happen at the Supreme Court this year. So that's why people were pressuring Stephen Breyer, hey, maybe this is a good idea for you to step down so that we can get a liberal appointee in there so it's not another conservative, because they were worried about how well the Republicans were going to do in this midterm cycle, which is also something we're going to talk about as well, of how successful were they really when you look at the big picture. But that was a concern. Now, Justice Breyer has said, nope, that was not the case at all, but we shall see where this all goes. Now let's go to number seven here. Number seven was something that was also pretty historic. That would be the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. Congress was able to pass and Biden was able to sign the first major gun safety piece of legislation in 30 years. Just about. That's incredible considering the, regardless of what party you believe in and whether you believe we need more gun rights or gun control, the fact is the NRA has a tight grip on Washington, and it's very hard to get any type of bills related to this matter passed. And the fact is they were able to pass it this year. Now, of course, this came in light of multiple mass shootings across the country, the biggest ones in Buffalo at the supermarket, and in Uvalde, Texas, at Robb Elementary School, where little ones were unfortunately murdered at the hands of an assailant who police, quite frankly, did not have a handle on. And that's obviously, there's a lot of debate to go on with that, but Congress and the president ended up acting. And as a result, this bill received bipartisan support from 15 GOP senators, including Texas Senator John Cornyn, who helped negotiate the bill because Uvalde is obviously in his home state, so he had some incentive there. South Carolina's Lindsey Graham and Missouri's Roy Blunt, who is retiring. But nonetheless, these are names you may have not traditionally heard of for this type of legislation. Yeah, you had the usuals, the Mitt Romneys, Elise Murkowski's, and the Susan Collins of the world. But a lot of the names that were on this list were, in fact, new to it. So the fact that they got this passed was a big, big deal. And it ended up passing 65-34, which the Democrats needed to get to the 60 threshold in order to overcome a filibuster, and they were able to, in fact, do that. So they were able to pass this, and the president was able to sign it. And there are gun control activists who are pushing for more, but the question will be how long they will actually be able to do that. Now let's look at what's actually in this bill. The law includes $750 million to help states implement and run crisis intervention programs, closes the boyfriend loophole, basically that a domestic violence partner, basically someone who abuses their domestic partner, they are now also not allowed to obtain a firearm. It previously was only if you were married or living with the person, but now it also includes if you had any type of romantic relationship with them. This also requires more gun sellers to register as federally licensed firearm dealers. And it requires more thorough reviews of people ages 18 to 21 who want to buy guns. As you know, with both these shootings, they were younger gentlemen. So that was a piece of incentive to maybe vet these guys a little harder, that there's some psychological problems potentially there that are not being addressed. So that's what they did with this bill. And it creates a new federal statute against gun trafficking and straw trafficking, and increases funding for mental health programs and school security, which that seemed to have a larger bipartisan support, but they didn't want more of these so-called red flag laws in there. So the Republicans didn't get as many as they would have hoped to support this. But nevertheless, that's still something that we haven't seen in a long time. Maybe not since we saw the 10-year assault weapons ban that came out of Congress in the 90s. But in the 2000s, did not get renewed, and we never saw it again. And we'll have to see whether the gun control activists get their way, or will gun rights activists have their say and be able to block some of this legislation. Now, we got to go in a different direction here. Number 6, the Mar-a-Lago raid. Now, this was a big one, and probably one that we wouldn't have even thought would be on this list. If we were sitting here this time last year, you'd be saying, this is crazy. But this happened. The FBI raided former President Trump's Palm Beach, Florida home after months of defying subpoenas and for failing to turn over White House documents. So basically, former President Trump had some documents in his home, and the government was trying to negotiate getting them back as part of the Archival Records Act, essentially, where all these papers are supposed to go into the public archive. They're supposed to be, the National Archive is supposed to be in charge of the documents. They are not meant to be taken to a non-government facility. They have to stay within the government. So they allege he shouldn't have even taken them out of the White House altogether. And a former president asserts that somehow they ended up, well, their story changes depending on what argument you're going to. But essentially the argument is that he didn't know that they had a lot of staffers packing stuff on him. It was very quick. So he didn't know that he had the documents. Then there's also stories which his former aide, Kash Patel, has signed off as he was a witness to former President Trump invoking executive privilege to allow him to take the documents with him. But nevertheless, it caused a firestorm here, which caused a special master to be appointed to review the documents seized in the raid, only to be taken off the case months later by a federal appeals court. And the political uproar on the right, they really became more anti-government in this moment. Because up till now, there was kind of the skepticism, because you're hearing now with what's coming out with the Twitter files, where Republicans are skeptical on how these law enforcement agencies are treating them. And this really came to a head in 2020, where the FBI was trying to suppress Russian disinformation, especially when it came to the Hunter Biden story and what we're seeing with the Twitter files on how they were basically in cahoots with Twitter in order to try and suppress information. Some people were saying that it was extending a little beyond what they should have been doing. And then you had Attorney General Merrick Garland label parents protesting at school board meetings as domestic terrorists. So there's been heat building up in the conservative movement about whether law enforcement agencies were really on their side anymore. At the very least, they were being fair, impartial, and solely there just to pursue justice. So you got all that in play. And then this Mar-a-Lago raid just comes and it just takes the lid and wipes it off all over the place, you know? The lid just popped off and could not be fixed for one moment here. So it really upset people. And there's still some lingering questions. Like, why the security camera footage? They had some security camera footage. Why was it not released at Mar-a-Lago? Now, they did ask to return the cameras off at one point, the FBI. Hey, can you turn the cameras off? The people at the Mar-a-Lago facilities had the cameras rolling. But we have not had that publicly released. Also, former President Trump is trying to advocate for an unredacted version of the affidavit used to get the search warrant to make that public. But that request has not been accepted. And we'll see if we ever get the full story here behind this. Because a lot of people say it's a political hit job. And then there's always these speculatory people online saying, oh, I don't think it had anything to do with that. It had something to do with January 6th. And especially now that he is back in the public sphere again, it makes people wonder where this goes next. And is there going to be a further conversation on political bias in this country when it comes to prosecuting cases? Which leads to story number 5 is Donald Trump announcing his 2024 bid. Now, former President Trump made it official last month, his intent to run for re-election in 2024. So he wants to go to the White House once again to pull off something that hasn't been done since Grover Cleveland, who was the last president and the only president to this date to win 2 consecutive terms in the White House. And this is the earliest a candidate has ever done so, to ever make this announcement. Usually you wait till like early 2023, mid-2023. You know, that's usually would be the time frame. Usually you want to do about a year and a half ahead time. You don't usually want to have too large of a runway because of campaign costs. And some people are saying this is a reason for Trump to be able to hide behind this glow of, hey, I'm running for president, you can't prosecute me right now. Basically try to kick the can down the road until he can get his legal strategy together, because he's got multiple legal battles going on. He's got investigations into the Trump Organization in New York. You've probably heard about some of that. You also got the taxes issues there. Well, the committees in Congress are starting to release some of that data. And we'll see how that plays with the American public, because as you know, Donald Trump did not want those taxes being released during the campaign. It seems like right now, mostly that they have is everything from when he was in the White House, and they found that he wasn't even being audited the way he was. So we're going to see how this plays out. And this story is interesting of a former president trying to run. Now, polls show, as we spoke about a couple weeks ago on this show, that Trump is losing some momentum here. We'll have to see whether this is a temporary thing or a permanent thing. Ron DeSantis is gaining some momentum. He's getting some popularity. Also, Biden's starting to get a little bit of an edge on Trump in some of these polls. So the question is, can Trump win? If he can win the primary, can he win the general election? And if it's a general election, it's going to be a rematch of like we haven't seen since Dwight Eisenhower ran twice. He ran twice against the same Democrat. And that Democrat ended up losing worse the second time around. So the question will be, what can Trump bring to the table this time? Is Biden's low approval ratings going to be enough to get Trump or DeSantis or whoever the Republican nominee is over the finish line? If Biden decides to run, and if he doesn't run, will that Democrat be attached to Biden by the hip? Now, there are a lot of big discussions here that we've had this year, and political issues, there were a plethora. But this one was a worldwide one. It comes in at number 4, which would be the Ukraine war, because it affects so many things, so many problems that already started before the Ukraine war just got worse as a result of it. And this has created a debate within Washington about how much government aid should be sent and used in this war. Some people were wondering, should we be sending any money into Ukraine? Should we significantly cut it? As you know, we have spent billions of dollars on this war, and a lot of Americans are not happy about it. They do not want their tax dollars going into this. There is a libertarian line of thinking here that we shouldn't even be in this war, that we should just leave this for all the other countries to deal with. Let's stay out of it. There's people who don't want troops on the ground. There's people who don't want any military help at all. But now, as we've learned from last week, when Zelensky came by, there will be Patriot missiles going to Ukraine. So they're going to get some more weaponry from the U.S., despite claims that you've heard from possible incoming House Speaker Kevin McCarthy saying that he was going to actively try to cut the amount of aid that Ukraine is getting. And largely received bipartisan support in Washington for this aid. But if you look outside of the Beltway, there are a lot of Americans who do not want this, and specifically on the Republican side. While Democrats seem to be a little more in favor of helping those Ukrainians out. But as I said, a lot of people feel like there's more problems at home that need to be dealt with. And a lot of the problems do stem or have been worsened by the Ukraine war. And that would be inflation, because a lot of the goods come from Ukraine. Ukraine is a big provider of wheat. They farm wheat there. So when the war started, the supply chain got screwed up because obviously they didn't have a pathway to get it out of there. And also the Russians seized a lot of these wheat farms. So that there was less product even being produced in the first place. Then you had the gas prices because there was a big energy hub. There was that gas pipeline that goes right underneath Ukraine, and that caused high gas prices. Well, the gas prices were already going up to begin with, and that made it worse. So this was a political battle. Republicans have used this largely to a moderate success in the midterms. And this is going to be an interesting story to see how this plays out, because President Zelensky was here in Washington, in America, last week, meeting with President Biden, speaking before Congress. And that is what we're going to have to see, is how that translates into the American people. Is that galvanize them more? Are they going to say, screw this guy, we're done, we're on to the next thing? Is it going to be more of this Vietnam moment where this war is going to go on forever, but we don't want to be a part of it? Now, I want to talk about story number 3. I was alluding to this earlier about what was happening at the Supreme Court. Well, this was a monumental decision that really changed the dynamics here of the legal system in this country. And that would be the striking down of Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court decided to overturn Roe v. Wade in a 5-4 landmark decision. Now, Roe v. Wade was the law of the land for almost 50 years in this country. And now it has been completely struck down here. And this ruling was a part of the Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Healthcare Organization challenging Mississippi's abortion ban. So this was the case that essentially did it. And it was kind of interesting the whole way this came out, right? They rolled this out. This was a leaked thing. They still supposedly have not found the person who leaked it out to Politico to report on of that draft decision, because it wasn't the finalized thing. In the draft, they had it be a 6-3 decision and ended up being a 5-4 with John Roberts basically supporting the Mississippi abortion ban, but not striking down Roe v. Wade. While the other five conservative justices, they all were in on the, hey, let's send this back to the states routine. So this has obviously eroded a lot of people's trust in the Supreme Court because they see it as more of a political entity now because of the way that the Republicans galvanize their base, getting them out to the polls saying, hey guys, listen, if we want to win, we got to put judges in there that are going to be to our favor. And obviously you have Democrats worried about that, which is why Ketanji Brown Jackson was appointed to the Supreme Court to essentially deal with the problems of what happens when you get a conservative majority. So everyone's playing politics with this thing, and we're going to have to see how much this becomes a extremely political issue in this country. And is this a voting issue, which we'll talk about in a moment? Or is this just a legal matter that's going to keep going up and down courts for as long as we know it? Is this just going to be a ping pong effect depending on who's in power and what judges are making these rulings? And it just is the whole story of it, this Hollywood sensationalist tale, because this was already a big thing going into June, that towards the end of the term that they were going to rule on this. But then the fact that this was leaked and that we don't know, even though there were only about 34 people who would have access to these, that has not been released publicly who is the one who did the leak. And this has been an institution that has been known for its secrecy and respecting the process. And it looks like that may have been not the same story that was happening here. It may have been that process did not matter. And we're going to have to see, because this decision has caused many states to reassess their abortion laws they have on the books. Because there's a lot of states, they don't have any abortion laws on the books. So it's not banned, it's not protected either. So they now have to decide whether they want to ban them or whether they want to protect. And then there's some states that prepped for this and they already had their abortion laws in place. And then there's others where they had the laws on the books, but because of Roe v. Wade, they no longer applied, but now they are being implemented. So it's a lot of legal limbo that could play out at the ballot box. Speaking of the ballot box, we have number two we have to talk about. And number two would be the Republicans gaining seats in the House. So they took the majority in the House, as many analysts suspected. But Republicans got a slimmer majority than a lot of pundits were predicting out there, with only 5 seats making the difference between being able to block the Biden agenda and failing to keep their priorities at top of mind. So 5 people can make a difference. 5 people can make or break this thing. That's what Kevin McCarthy's dealing right now with the whole speakership battle, because there's a handful of Republicans that are not voting for him unless they get what they want. And McCarthy needs every vote he can get. Every vote. Because there's only 5 people that, basically, it's really 4 if he wants to get the majority. He can only lose 4. But if he loses 5, it's game over. It's not majority anymore. It's neck and neck. And that's more a problem because he got past his conference, but now he's got to get the majority in the whole House. And they don't have tons and tons of members like in the past where you'd have a 20, 30, 40 seat majority where you're all right, well, this person doesn't want to vote for me. Well, I'll have such and such vote for me instead. But no, he needs everybody on board for this. And that will be the interesting battle that the Republicans have to face. And now a lot of these Republicans ran on inflation. They ran on crime. And that seemed to work in a lot of places that some people wouldn't suspect. In New Jersey, there was a pickup. It was Congressman-elect Tom Kaine, who beat out Tom Malinowski in a re-election battle match there. And that happened in 2020. Well, now this was a more favorable district lines for Tom Kaine. Kaine beat him 51% to 49%. And only about 9,000 votes really made the difference there. So shows you voting matters for sure. And how delicate the situation was, and that what issues matter to these voters. So very important to bring up there. And Republicans did very well in New York. They picked up 4 seats there. In California, they picked up a ton. And Oregon, they picked one out in the suburbs of Portland, which is something we haven't seen in a long time either. So with a combination of that, they were able to string this together to create a Republican victory, despite overall failure to meet expectations. It was not the red wave. Some people would argue red fizzle. Some people would argue it was nothing. And that's because of our story of number one. The number one story is the Democrats gain a seat in the Senate. This was not supposed to happen. If you remember listening to this show, basically days going into this, the Democrats were pretty much projected by most of these major analysts to lose the Senate, in fact. They were not expected to keep it. At the very best, they might have kept the 50-50 scenario, but no one foresaw a pickup happening. And that was largely because of Pennsylvania, where Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman beat celebrity surgeon Dr. Oz 51% to 46%, around that, to win the Senate seat there. That is something that was unbelievable considering how tight races in Pennsylvania have been in the last 4 or 5 years or so. This has been a swing state, but this was a pretty decisive victory for Fetterman. And in the governor's race, it was even more decisive. And a lot of people were wondering who to blame for that. Some people blame Trump. Some people blame the abortion issue, as I mentioned, Roe v. Wade, as a galvanizer in some of these states for candidates who may have not been as exciting. Candidate quality is also something that's being criticized on the Republican side. And some people are saying the Democrats had some good candidates. Now, in John Fetterman's case, a lot of people say he's not equipped to handle this job because of his stroke, and some people think he needs to spend more time recovering before he jumps back into public life, and there'll be an interesting battle to see there. And this is not the only place that allowed the Democrats to gain this majority. It's now an outright majority. Right now, it's a 50-50 scenario, but starting January, it's going to be an outright majority. A narrow one, but still a majority. Now, what helped them get to this point was Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto barely holding on in Nevada. And here's the margin, 48.8% to 48% against Adam Laxalt, the Republican. So this was under 8,000 votes that made the difference. So Republican strength kind of worked there because they won the governorship there, but they did not win the Senate seat, which has some people worried about 2024 on the Democratic side because, yes, she did perform better than expectations, but up until months leading into this, it was not even it was not a swing seat at all. So Nevada will be a closely watched state going into 2024. And similar margins to Pennsylvania happened in Arizona that allowed Mark Kelly to keep the seat there. Georgia, it went to a runoff, and Senator Raphael Warnock won there by almost 3 percentage points. So there was a strength for Democrats in the Senate. Governor's races, they did pretty decent on. They kept the governor's mansion in Wisconsin in Democratic hands. They kept it in Democratic hands in Michigan with Gretchen Whitmer. And New York, that was an interesting one, but despite all the hype, Kathy Hochul was still able to pull that one out. Yes, it was the single digits, but she still pulled it out. But the interesting thing about some of these is that the governor's race went one way, but the Senate went another. In Wisconsin, the Democrats got the governorship while the Republicans got the Senate seat. And Nevada was flip-flopped, where the Republicans got the governorship, but the Democrats got the Senate. And you kind of saw this split ticket thing going on across the country. Basically, because of the issues that I addressed, that there's a lot on the line, there's a lot of different issues, but we are going to see how this plays out for 2023. And the question is, what can we expect in 2023? Now, I told you all about my stories and what I think, but what is the actual, what's going on here? What can we expect to see, as well as looking back at this year, what were the weird things, the things no one caught, the stories that kind of went under the radar, but we have to remember and talk about if we're going to go on to do things in 2023. What were those things? Well, here to discuss that with me is Jersey First TV's Real Talk with Fernando Uribe host, Dr. Fernando Uribe. Fernando, thanks for coming on.
Always, always.
Well, obviously, you know, Fernando, there's a lot of big stories that happened this year. A lot of to break down to, a lot of remembering, a lot to look back at. But of all the things you can think of, what was the most memorable political event of the year?
Wow. I'll tell you, Joey, there's a lot to choose from here. I would argue probably the announcement that Governor Phil Murphy is looking to do an assessment of his COVID response. Unfortunately, that report will not be made available until after next year's legislative elections, which, you know, is very convenient since next November, all 80 assembly seats are up for grabs and all 40 Senate seats are up for grabs. And obviously, Democrats hold majorities in both chambers of the legislature. It did get reduced somewhat after 2021. And I think that Republicans feel very emboldened after what happened this year during the midterm election. Obviously, they were able to flip one congressional seat. Certainly, that's what the map was designed to do. And it's my understanding that after redistricting, you know, for legislative districts, I think that Republicans may not have an overwhelming advantage, but I think they're in better shape to challenge Democrats. So I just find it interesting that, you know, again, the report won't be out until after, you know, the election next year. But I would, you know, the fact of Governor Murphy, who, again, preached this, oh, I know everything, I'm following science, which we all know was not true. And the governor, I think, is showing some self-awareness here. I think obviously he has aspirations for higher office. I think he wants to sort of put transparency on the table when it comes to his COVID response, which we all know was very flawed compared to other governors who got COVID right. I know that that's a bitter pill for a lot of people to swallow in New Jersey, especially those on the left. But I would argue that that sort of admission by the governor to have an independent commission look into this. Again, I'm skeptical of who's going to be on this commission, because like anything else, you know, you have to worry about who's being appointed to this. But I would argue that was probably the biggest story of the year, because it affected so many millions of people. It still does.
Now, depending on what media outlet it is, there's a lot of stories that sometimes go under the radar, but are still very important to the year at hand. So in thinking of that context, what would you say was the most undercovered political moment?
Great question again. I would say I think the ability of the sort of traditional media outlets in New Jersey kind of failing. We're seeing layoffs with the Star Ledger. We were seeing layoffs with the Bergen Record. We saw layoffs with NJ 101.5 FM. Again, no one's going to accuse that radio station of being liberal, but they've been an institution in media here in the state for many years. So I would say that the amount of layoffs going on, and again, I would see it while checking my emails, whether it's NJ.com, NorthJersey.com, all these sort of traditional news sites asking, readers to be like, oh, listen, subscribe now for premium content or help us keep journalism local. And I just thought for all the disservice that the Star Ledger and NJ.com has done us, and even NorthJersey.com, the Bergen Record too, Joey, like now it seems like the chickens are coming home to roost. And it's a shame. I don't like to see anybody, lose their jobs. I mean, Michael Simons, I would argue, is one of the best journalists in the state. He was laid off by NJ 101.5 FM. So I think the ability of traditional media dying out is really, I think, gone under the radar. And it's a shame because there's a lot of talent. There's a lot of bad people in journalism, which I talk about weekly on my show. But there's a lot of good reporters that I think are either forced to go somewhere else or now unemployed. And I think the fact that it's not getting covered the way it should be, I think is a travesty.
Now, in addition to the undercovered, sometimes there's just the weird, the strange, the unordinary things that just pop up. You kind of just start scratching your head being like, what happened here? If you're thinking of those type of stories, what's the weirdest thing that happened in politics this year?
I think that I'm speaking for conservatives because I'm an openly conservative guy. I think we got a wake-up call in terms of who Republicans need, and I'll sort of use a poker reference here, who Republicans and conservatives need to put their chips behind moving forward. I think that it became obvious that the 45th president's coattails were not what they once were. It showed nearby in Pennsylvania. He could not, for example, get Dr. Oz across the finish line to win that Senate seat over a guy who's virtually a mummy, okay? And somehow he won there in Pennsylvania. And other Senate candidates, and again, there were some not very good ones, right? We had one in Georgia who, even being as bad as he was, still came within half a percentage point of winning in a runoff earlier in this month. I would say I think that Republicans and conservatives, I think, have to reevaluate their affinity and devotion to Donald Trump. I think that it shows that he has fallen out of favor with a lot of traditional Republicans, conservatives as well. And I think moving forward, conservatives and Republicans alike have to make a decision going into 2023 and 2024 that, hey, who's going to be the head of the party coming up? Who's going to be that focal point for Republicans in challenging Joe Biden in 2024. Again, it's still about economy. This is a president who has no problems sending billions upon billions of dollars to Ukraine where we should not be there, okay? It's not something that should interest us. It doesn't benefit us whatsoever. But yet people are still struggling to pay for groceries, Joey, okay? Our Thanksgiving dinners were more expensive this year. And, it just seems like the president's priorities are once again out of whack. He'd rather send billions of dollars to Ukraine or subscribe to woke nonsense with whoever he appoints to his cabinet. And regular Americans, I think, are getting the raw deal. And I think Republicans need to do some work here about who they're going to rally behind. I hate to say it. I know a lot of MAGA Republicans that know me and like my content are going to be mad when I say this, but it can't be Donald Trump anymore. It's got to be someone like Ron DeSantis, a governor, a two-term governor who got it right on COVID, who governs well, who knows responsible spending. I think that probably that's the biggest story this year. I think Republicans are happy they won the House, not the margins they would have liked. They didn't win the Senate. I think there needs to be a come to Jesus moment for Republicans moving forward if they want to A, win the Senate in 2024 and get back the presidency, which again is really, it's a coin toss at this point, Joe.
Are we breaking some news here? Are you officially not on the Trump train anymore? You're joining Team DeSantis?
I would say yes. I think I'll go on record right now and say that. I think that I'm being pragmatic here. And I think a lot of people, if they're being intellectually honest, Joey, I think they have to look in the mirror and say, what's the best move for the party? And I get it. Listen, there are elements of Donald Trump that I still like. I think, you know, a lot of people on the left in New Jersey won't admit it openly. But one of the reasons I gravitated towards Trump and was a staunch defender of Trump is, A, he got it right on judges, which he did. There were a lot of economic policies that I could rally around. There was criminal justice reform that went underreported in the mainstream liberal media during his presidency. But I think that that's it. I think that, you know, clearly this is a guy who just can't seem to get out of his own way. And Ron DeSantis is being smart right now. You haven't heard a peep from him. I think he's sort of just letting Donald Trump hang himself with whatever comments he's making, whatever's going on with him litigation-wise, you know, all that stuff. I think Ron DeSantis is playing a smart game. He knows policy. He's governed well. And I think that on a debate stage, what's Donald Trump going to attack him on? What? Oh, I don't know. What, his military service in the Navy? Negative. What's he going to say? Oh, you didn't govern correctly on COVID. Wrong. He did. What's he going to get him on? So I think Ron DeSantis, I think, is a more polished, more articulate version of Trump, but he has the governing behind him. And I think that, again, he checks off a lot of boxes. So I would say I'm definitely on the DeSantis train.
Now, let's say that either the two men, they get in a primary and Trump wins, or let's just say DeSantis says, hi, I'm bowing out. Thanks for the offer, but I think I'm just going to stay governor of Florida right now, and Trump ends up winning the nomination. Would you still support and vote for him in 2024 if former President Trump is going up against President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, or really anyone that the Democrats have?
Oh, no, absolutely. I would completely support Donald Trump. I think that, you know, to quote the great Ben Shapiro, it would be hard for me to vote for a Democrat because, A, they have to stop being nuts on a national level. I think the party on a national level is just exemplifying a level of insanity, whether it's about subscribing to woke nonsense, not getting it right on energy. Clearly, this foreign policy with Ukraine is costly. Yeah, no, I would not vote for Joe Biden. I think anyone who can defend Joe Biden without, again, if you want to get into the semantics of, well, Joe Biden's compassionate, Joe Biden's doing A, B, and C, Joe Biden is making this country more expensive to live in. Joe Biden is subscribing to energy policies that are doing a disservice to Americans. Joe Biden is having a disastrous foreign policy. Now, again, there's a lot to clean up with Donald Trump. I think, A, he surrounds himself with bad people who advise him. Now, again, it's hard to reel in a guy like that with advisors and say, listen, Mr. President, I think you need to, you know, kind of tone this down. It's hard to do that with someone like Donald Trump. I mean, he's an alpha male of almost on steroids. But I think that if he is the nominee to your hypothesis, and let's say it's not Ron DeSantis, A, he needs a comparable running mate. I would say a woman not someone like either someone who's been in government, not some up and coming person, not some congressperson. No, I need like either a governor, a former governor like Nikki Haley, or someone of that capacity that can be a comparable sort of multifaceted, multi-dimensional ticket. That's what Donald Trump needs. But I think we're a long way away from that, Joey. I think that the former president's got a lot on his plate. And I think Republicans are going to come for him. I think Republicans don't just want to just give him the nomination. I think they want to make him earn it. If he earns it, hey, God bless him. But I think if we're being intellectually honest, especially us conservatives, like myself, I think we have to be intellectually honest about what's the better version for the party. See, I like to win, but I'm also a chess guy. I'm a long game guy. What's in the better interest of the party? And I think Donald Trump's time it's come and gone. I'm sorry. I'm not saying that to be mean or hateful. I got to look at the tea leaves. And someone like Ron DeSantis seems like a better fit, especially if you want to win over independents. That's what got Trump elected in 2016. That's what lost him in 2020. Republicans need to get back to that, winning independents over, because that's how you win elections.
Now, I want to bring it back to this year. A big story that dominated the headlines this year was the Dobbs decision overturning decades of precedent that abortion was the law of the land. How will this affect abortion law in the country for years to come?
Well, it's interesting because I talked about this at length on my show on Jersey First, and I don't have a law degree, but you don't need one to understand that what the Supreme Court did with the Dobbs decision basically is relegated to the states. And for anyone, again, that maybe didn't take constitutional law in college or never read a history book, again, the 10th Amendment, Joey, is very specific. And I have it here because it actually, I have a picture of the Bill of Rights as a mouse pad in my home office. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. What the conservative majority told Americans is, hey, we're not going to rule on this. We're not outlawing abortion federally, which, again, is a very big component, right? The left and propagandists in New Jersey have weaponized this to the point of creating mass hysteria. It's simply relegated to the states. Case in point in New Jersey, they codified it into state law. So it boggles my mind when I hear all these insufferable feminists and all these cat ladies, like, just on their hysteria since June, weaponizing it for fundraising. When it comes to reproductive rights, it's been codified into New Jersey law. Case in point, why do you think the amendment that was being floated around to amend the New Jersey Constitution was being, you know, discussed about, hey, maybe that might be a referendum on the ballot in 2023? Because Democrats, far left Democrats, know that it's a low turnout year with legislative seats. Why not rally up the base by having an amendment to the no, we don't need to amend any document, the U.S. Constitution or the New Jersey Constitution. It's been codified into state law. If you want to get an abortion in New Jersey, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, I think up until, you know, whatever it is, 36 weeks, you can get an abortion in New Jersey. Okay. If you want to get a Plan B at your local Walgreens or CVS, guess what? You have options. You have access to that. So the idea that, you know, the hysteria by left and by many women in New Jersey just drives me crazy. And I know that sounds kind of rough, but it's the truth. I mean, whatever Texas is doing, Joey, whatever Florida is doing, whatever Alabama is doing, that's their right. Again, it's federalism. It's states' rights. Now, women in New Jersey may not like what they do in Tennessee, but you don't live there, okay? Like, I went crazy this fall basically saying it's literally women – bitching and moaning about not being able to terminate pregnancies in states that they don't live in. Worry about New Jersey. Whatever Florida does, do you think people in Tennessee care that here in the Garden State we coddle illegals and we subsidize legal funds to represent illegals in court to fight deportations, or that we give illegals driver licenses here in New Jersey? They don't care anymore what we do, then we should care about what they do. That's their business, just like it's ours. We codified it in New Jersey. That's it. The idea that feminists and all these cat ladies are still having meltdowns to me is just egregious. And it's sickening at this point already.
Jersey First TV's Real Talk with Fernando Uribe host, Dr. Fernando Uribe. Thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Joey, Merry Christmas to you. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Festivus to all of your wonderful listeners. You keep up the great work, young man, because you are doing amazing, amazing journalism. God bless you and your family.
Thank you, Fernando. I appreciate that. Well, that about wraps it up for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me. So obviously, we've been through the holiday seasons now, and since this is the final show of 2022, I want to wish you a very happy new year to you and your family. This is a big time of year, so continue to carry the joy, and we'll be back next year, next week, right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.